This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the average U.S. temperature in February 2025 be higher than 36 degrees Fahrenheit? The yes forecast contract recently traded at 44% and the no was at 55%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change, the economy, or even politics. You choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore historical data on U.S. and global temperatures and even carbon dioxide levels. Spot the trend and make your predictions for February 2025. Trade forecast contracts at Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every contract correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% annual percentage yield on your investments with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. Interactive Brokers is a member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Is it possible to invest like an Ivy School endowment? Factor investing and exchange funds and new advice for investors. Get your pencil sharpened because Meb Favor, co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambry Investment Management, is here. All this and much more on episode number 910 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a warm and healthy welcome to March. Yeah, I know, you're thinking, where'd the time go? I mean, I think that all the time, right? Oh my God, it's March already. I mean, what happened to February? What happened to January? Here we go. I mean, just make sure you're making the most of your time and, dare I say, your portfolio is working for you. And that you're informed and that you know and you have an agreement with yourself that you're not getting any younger. I hate to say it. We're all getting older, and the truth of the matter is that we need to make our money work hard for us. To all our new listeners, hello. I'm Andrew Horowitz. Been on this podcast thing since 2007 and still bringing it. I got to tell you, still bringing it week after week with superb A-level guests, and I'm really pleased about that. I've mentioned over the last few weeks that we have some great guests lined up over the past few weeks and over the next number of months. So make sure to stay tuned, spend time here, learning from them as much as you can, because these are some of the best minds in the industry when we're talking about finance. You can follow me on Twitter. It's hashtag the sign, the ampersand, or the follow tag sign, Andrew Horowitz. Bottom line, one word. It's Andrew Horowitz, and you can follow me over on Twitter, and we make sure to put the information about when the podcasts are coming out there first and foremost. You can, of course, get it on Amazon Music or Apple Podcasts. Spotify is a great one for us as well. The big one is Apple Podcast and has been. YouTube also, we just started that, so not a lot of hits on that because most people are used to listening to us on all these other ones. But the bottom line is here that we have great guests and we have great information. As I had mentioned, I'm going to just tell you once again that at the beginning of this year, my goal was to bring you some really healthy education from some of the best and talking about not only investments, but ways to invest and how to invest and the psychology of investing and just areas that you may not have been used to, and do it in a way that we really focus on the conversations, because we can get some of the information about what's happening with the markets on a regular basis. All you need to do is open up the blank, blank, blank finance page of any news site, watch the tube, or I don't know, dare I say, maybe look to other of these podcasts that just focus in on what happened today in the markets. That's not what we're doing. That's not what it's all about right here. What we're doing right now is focusing in on the educational portion of what we're doing. So with that, not going to spend a lot of time talking about other things other than that. So let's get right to our guest. And let me tell you all about who this person is today, because it comes with, as I think, one of the best minds in the business. And he's co-founder and the chief investment officer of Cambria Investment Management. And he is manager of Cambria's ETFs, C-A-M-B-R-I-A, Cambria. And also of their separate accounts. He's also the host of the Meb Faber Show podcast and has authored numerous white papers and, dare I say, leather-bound books. He's a frequent speaker and writer on investment strategies, and he's been featured in Barron's, the New York Times, and the New Yorker. He graduated from the University of West Virginia, double major in engineering science and biology. So with that, let's bring him right on. So let's get right down to it with my good friend Meb Faber. Meb, how are you?
Hey, bud. Good to be back.
It's been a while. I always enjoy talking to you because you have such a wide spectrum of things we can talk about. And I wanted to start out with a very generalistic discussion of some of the key investment strategies that you've developed and the things that have worked well for you over the years. And by the way, just so I can get into this, I want to get into some other things about some of your books. And then also I want to talk about the area of factors. So I'm just kind of setting that up for the beginning overview.
Great. There's nothing I won't talk about. Hopefully you find something, but yeah, let's do it.
So tell me about some of the strategies that you've kind of found that have worked.
Oh boy. You know, we often say there's two columns when it comes to markets, and there's not a whole lot of overlap, but they're both really long. And the columns are things that are totally fine. And then on the other side of the ledger, things that are absolutely atrocious, right? And there's plenty of ways to invest that are just fine. And I think people obsess too much over the specifics, the minutiae. But it's funny, if you got a group of us together and we said, hey, look, like, what's the most important thing in investing? And we could go on and on. It's like the old food investing pyramid, right? Mm-hmm. I think most of us would probably agree on some of the major inputs, like how much you save and invest in the first place is really important. You know, avoiding taxes, really important, on and on. And so the hard part is when we get, you know, you and I together over playing some pickleball or a beer or something, you know, a steak, is we end up debating the final 10% or something, because that's the place that people tend to disagree more. So anyway, what has worked? Well, we often tell people survival is the most important, right? if you get taken out of the game, if you bet all your chips and you lose, you can't play. It's like playing poker. You know, you lose all your chips, you can't play anymore. But people, not that infrequently, still do it. And they want to think in binary terms. Is the S&P expensive? Okay, do I have to sell it? Is it going to double, or is it going to crash? Should I be in or out? I mean, the amount of times I've heard someone say, Meb, should I buy your fund or this other fund? And they hate the answer, but sometimes I'm like, why don't I just buy both? Mm-hmm. Well, that's unsatisfying. That's like cheering for both the Denver Broncos and the Miami Dolphins. Like, nobody wants to cheer for, you know, two teams playing each other. Right. Except my wife. She'll be like, I want both these teams to win.
Oh, they're so nice.
Yeah.
I like the uniforms.
But the reality is there's plenty of ways to invest. But, you know, I think the biggest mistakes most investors make are they're way too concentrated. So Americans, my American friends, I'm looking at you, but this is true everywhere in the world. People put way too much in their own market. If you're Japanese, if you're British, if you're Brazilian, on and on, you put most of your money in your own market, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We believe you should be diversified globally, but also diversified by assets. So not just global stocks, global bonds, and also global real assets. Often we see Americans are pretty low in those. And so that means things like gold, which is knocking on 3,000. Things like commodities, but also real estate, REITs, TIPS is another one that's sort of a blend of fixed income and real assets. And then after you get your bases covered on those three main asset classes, we fully believe in tilts to things like value. We use shareholder yield. And then also things like trend following, which is probably our biggest departure from traditional investors across our 16 funds. But again, it's all those things, of course, being mindful of fees and even more being mindful of taxes along the way. And all that with the theme to have a plan so that behaviorally, when it hits the fan, you don't get taken out and sell everything. How many times did you hear in 2009, I sold everything, I couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
And then I didn't get back in, Meb, until 2011, 2013, 2015, 2017. And then now we've had one of the best periods ever in history for U.S. stocks. It's just been an astonishing period the last 15 years.
Yeah. A couple of things to glean from that discussion. First of all, one of the things that Meb was talking about is an area that maybe he didn't coin this, but you've used a lot. It's home country bias. The idea that I'm here in the United States, so the stocks here are good. But then I would say, well, what happened if you lived somewhere else? You'd be thinking, well, those stocks are over there. These stocks are over here.
Here's the funny thing about this is U.S. as a percentage of the world market cap is about 2/3 today. So that means you're putting 10 times as much in the U.S. as the second biggest country in the world. And so I often tell my American friends, I'm like, you're already all in on U.S. stocks, yeah. Right? Like that's astonishing. But the U.S. isn't always the largest market cap. So in the 80s, Japan was the largest stock market. Now, of course, Japan has cured that by going nowhere for 30 years. But what's fascinating about this topic is it's time dependent. So Vanguard and others have put out some research. The amount that you put into stocks, your allocation, is dependent upon when you're born. So if you live through 2008, 2009, or you live through 99 to 03, or you live through the 70s, inflationary 70s, mm-hmm. On and on. There's not many people around that lived through the Great Depression when stocks went down over 80%. But informs how you invest, which makes sense, right? That's evolutionary biology. Like you learn from your snakes. You put your hand on the stove, you'd be really dumb to keep doing that. And same thing with stocks. Like if you get punched in the face, you lose. And old traders, are the most humble of all investors. You learn from that. But this also applies to foreign markets. But the fascinating thing about home country bias is it's also true within the U.S., So if you live in the Northeast, guess what? You overweight financials. You live in Texas, you overweight energy. You live like me out in California, you overweight tech stocks. And so JP Morgan Guide to the Markets tracks this. They also track the home country bias and it's way worse in other countries. So US, it's not so bad because it's majority of the world's market cap. But if you live in the UK, if you live in Japan, you live in Australia, and you put 50, 75% in your own stock market, That's a massive, massive overweight versus their market cap as a percentage of the world, which is like 3%. But here's a fun stat I was tweeting about the other day. People say, Meb, yeah, but you've been wrong. Global diversification hasn't worked the past 15 years. And I say, hold on a second. It's worked in 44 out of 45 countries in the world. That's a pretty good track record. It just hasn't worked in one, which is the U.S. Now, if you lived in Brazil or Japan, and you globally diversified, it's worked amazing. But let's back up further. Let's go back to 1900. Of the 12 decades, if you look at each one independently, and this is Bridgewater research, and you compare the U.S. versus the equal weight of all the countries available at the time, how many countries, listeners, do you think the U.S. has outperformed the equal weight out of 12? I think most people would say like 8, 12, mm-hmm. maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the answer is 4. So only a third of the time. Now, it just happens to be that it was
last
recent,
couple years,
but everyone extends the recent past. So anyway, look, our largest fund is a U.S. Stock ETF, SYLD. So nothing would benefit me more than U.S. stocks just continuing on to the moon. But the reality is good times follow the bad. And if you put all your chips on one market, particularly when we think the broad U.S. market is expensive across most valuation metrics. Now, that doesn't mean the rest of the stocks are expensive, but broadly speaking, you can end up with a whole lot of disappointment if things go sideways or God forbid, down a lot over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, another little tidbit that you said in the beginning of this discussion was there's a lot of things that go into the idea of investing, the philosophy, the actual doing, the process. And the last 10% is this whole discussion of, oh, should I be value? Should I be this? Should I be that? When in fact, a lot of the things, which I think a lot of people don't really have stuck in their brains enough is that it is about the continual investing, pushing money into the, you know, I tell clients all the time, look, I'm doing the work. I'm doing this heavy work of pulling the portfolio and all that. But you know what? If you want, there's nothing wrong with you putting some money in to help it out as well, to grow it, to help compound it.
People love to look at real estate and they say, oh my gosh, I bought this house. My parents bought this house for $100,000. Now it's worth $3 million. This is a good example of an investment that's done great. And we often tell people, we say, look, real estate's magical, not because it performs that well. It's okay. But largely because it forces you to save and invest that money that you would probably spend otherwise, right? You know, go buy a new boat, on and on, go get a new pickleball paddle. But the same thing is to stocks and investing. And so having this on autopilot, putting it away, particularly, you know, anything robotic and automated, but how much you save and invest in the first place is way more important than actually what you invest in. And I feel like that's a pretty non-consensus view that we hold, but I think it's true.
And I think it's smart. Now, in your book, The Ivy Portfolio, you explore how to invest like the top endowments. Now, by the way, you've been, you can correct me, but relatively critical of some of these endowments and some of the things that they do. Is that a fair statement?
I would say not just the endowments, but just large institutions in general.
Right. Large, stodgy, they're going to do it their way. And they, I don't know if they take the easy way out, but they take a consensus and a benchmark way out. Is that right? Would that make sense? Does that make sense?
So, you know, we wrote this book, Ivy Portfolio, is my first book, like 2007, 2008, 2009, somewhere in that period. And we took a look at David Swensen, who recently passed, but is arguably the greatest of all time is when it comes to institutional asset management. And we'll get into what is special in the water up in New Haven. But if you look at the average endowment, or you look at, say, my nemesis CalPERS here in California that manages hundreds of billions of dollars, or even if you look at Bridgewater, the largest hedge fund in the world, right? And you say these institutions have all the resources. They have access to the best investors all over the planet. They have teams of dozens, if not hundreds of employees, on and on. They should be able to outperform just a generic ETF buy and hold portfolio. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, historically, often they don't. So we've written a lot of articles over the years on Bridgewater, on CalPERS, say, should CalPERS be managed by a robot? Should CalPERS fire everyone and buy a bunch of ETFs? We're actually launching an endowment-style ETF in April, so we can get more into that in a minute. But if you look at Yale has been special, and they have outperformed by a few percentage points per year over time. Again, this sort of comes and goes. You know, the U.S. stock market, we wrote a piece last year I thought was a lot of fun called The Bear Market and Diversification. And we looked at U.S. stocks. There's only been four times in history that U.S. stocks have done 15% per year for 10 years. And this is one of those. The other three have names: Roaring 20s, Nifty 50, Internet Bubble, and whatever calling this. So U.S. stocks have just been absolutely smashing. And they've outperformed virtually everything. And so this piece we did, we said, this has arguably been the worst period in history for a diversified portfolio relative to the S&P, not just in terms of absolute returns, but in terms of years in a row of underperformance. So the S&P has been really special. But what I'm kind of alluding to here is, if you look at the long-term track record of something like Yale when Swensen took over in the 80s, it's been very unique. And there's a couple of features of the endowments. First of all, they're not taxed. That's nice, right? Wish we could all say that.
Yep.
Second is, theoretically, they have a very, very long time horizon because their goal is to outperform inflation and be able to grow the endowment. But also, a lot of these universities have come to rely on the payouts from the endowment. And it's non-trivial amount of the budget for many of these actual schools. Some of them, it's like over half. And so, it's important not just to current students, but future students, on and on. And so the defining characteristic of the endowments is an equity-like focus. So if you look at Yale's annual reports, you'll be like, oh my God, they only have 3% in US stocks. Like, what institution does that? Now, to be fair, if you look at stock-like investments, it's up around half because it's private equity, it's venture capital, leveraged buyouts, you know, things that are stock-like, just not public US SPY. So they have an equity focus. The vast majority of their investments are in equity-like investments, which if you're a long-term investor and you hold for many years, you really want to be equity focused. They still, but they, the defining characteristic has also been, hey, look, we'll go out in search of active management where we think we can add value. And historically, for Yale and others, the big lever has been private equity and venture capital. And Yale's really been, I think, particularly special there. Many people have tried to copy the Yale model. Mm-hmm. And this, we've recently published a paper on this topic. And we say, hey, can you replicate Yale? And so it's very simple to replicate the average endowment. You can just put it in 60-40, right? Average endowment's not special. CalPERS, not special. You can buy a bunch of ETFs, no big deal. And to be clear, let me back up. That's not bad. All right. So buying a bunch of ETFs, having diversified allocation, that's great. You probably do 8-9% a year. And so again, over the last 15 years, you're like, there's nothing wrong with 8-9%. That's amazing. Yeah. Compound 8-9%. Sure. You're going to make a ton of money. However, just when the S&P is doing 15 or when Yale's doing, 12 or whatever it was, the worst thing you can do is the neighbor syndrome. Like, my neighbor's making a ton of money in NVIDIA and Fartcoin. What am I doing here with this nice diversified portfolio? But what we found is that, because Yale and a lot of these other institutions use investments that are leveraged, if you add some leverage to a diversified portfolio, we like to add tilts like value, you can get in line with the Yale returns over time, which is pretty cool. You got to be willing to endure the volatility. And the biggest sort of red X for a lot of the endowments, financial crisis was very painful for many of those because they had all these private investments and they got upside down on the illiquidity. And they have a nice feature, which is they only report returns once a year. So it'd be nice, right? June 30th, we report returns once a year. So it looks a lot smoother than it was. And we actually estimate their worst year. You can multiply that times two to come up with the intra-year drawdown. Mm. So, which was probably for most of the endowments over half. And, most investors over half is a pretty painful experience, but if you're equity focused and you have a lot of equity like assets, it's not out of the question.
It's interesting because that time horizon thing is something that I think people really, it's very difficult for them to get through their heads, because if you have a house, this is the biggest investment that most people have is their home. And it's nobody's looking, unless there are some people, looking at Zillow every day at what their Z estimate is on their house, right? What's the value of my house? Oh my God, it dropped by 10,000 today. I'm freaking out. What am I going to do? Let me call my advisor. Versus the combination of immediate access on a daily basis throughout the day of valuations of your portfolio and the nonstop news that's coming from all sorts of different areas, right? And they perceive that as volatility, but in fact, they lose sight of the real-time horizon, don't they?
Well, we asked Ken French on our podcast not too long ago. I said, Ken, so many investors are examining these funds. We have investors, they'll call us and say, Meb, I bought your fund 6 years ago. It's doing terrible. I think I'm going to sell it. And I sit there and I kind of pause. I'm like, what is your expectation? Like, what do you think a reasonable time horizon to analyze this fund? We actually did this on Twitter once. And everyone said, if it underperforms 0 to 3 years, it's out. So we asked Ken French, world famous professor, said, how many years, statistically speaking, do we need to know if an asset or a manager has skill? And he said 64 years.
64.
And 64. And I laughed, and I was like, well, most investors, they're not going to wait that long. They're not going to wait 10 years. But, Morgan Housel has a great quote this last week on Twitter where he said the majority of investing mistakes come from trying to cram long-term returns into shorter periods of time. Mm-hmm. Just be more patient. It's not more complicated than that. And the problem for most investors is the regimes that this stuff can play out on last way longer than people expect. Stocks can go nowhere for decades. You can have one asset underperforming another for forever, on and on. And so the challenge, I think, for most people is to get totally unrealistic expectations of what can and will happen. You know, Vanguard put out some studies. They look at, even if you pick the best investors, how often out of a decade or 15 years did they underperform? And in many cases, you know, so when I talked to that investor that said, Meb, you've been underperforming 6 months, I said, oh, it can get way worse than that. You know, this fund can underperform this fund can underperform years in a row and still be a spectacular choice. So if you're not prepared to wither the drawdowns, and this creates all the bad behavior where people chase, you know, the shining stars, they sell the losers. And there's been academic research. And this is the problem with CalPERS and a lot of the institutions, too, is they found the academics have shown that over thousands and thousands of hiring and firing decisions, the institutions are just as bad as individuals. We all like to look down on these crazy retail investors, but the reality is the, you know, sophisticated committees do the same thing. They look at funds and strategies that have underperformed the last 3 years. They sell them. They go and buy something that's outperformed the last 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
And the academic literature shows they would be better off if they'd stuck with the manager that was underperforming instead of chasing the hot returning manager. So this performance chasing is, you know, I think probably the biggest problem. But setting up an asset allocation, you know, and sticking with it, I think is way more important than all the effort that, you know, most people stress out about.
The diversification hopping, the moving in and out, I remember that very distinctly from 1998. Let's call about 1998. When 1998, actually before that, value was very hot. Right, everybody was loading up on a few different advisors out there, the big names. It was, and I can't remember the name now. They were bought. It was Northern Trust on one side, and it was Bernstein on the other side. That's what it was. I don't know if you remember this. And at least in the circles up here, you know where I am, or down here where I am. And everybody was buying Bernstein and Bernstein, and all of a sudden Bernstein got cold, and Northern Trust got really hot. Well, what did they do? They moved out of, on the downstroke, they moved out of Bernstein at the last minute. They moved into the high levels as it was really cranking into Northern Trust, which was a go-go growth manager. And they got totally burned in 2000. They got double burned.
It's hard for investors. We often say it's important to be asset class agnostic. And that's hard. You know, I'm a Denver Broncos fan. There is no scenario where I'm ever cheering for the Raiders. But people get caught up and they're like, you know what? They get emotionally attached to their investments. It could be U.S. stocks currently. It could be their NVIDIA. It could be gold. You know, if you're a gold bug, it's knocking on 3,000. I mean, the best example, of course, is Bitcoin. You know, people, there's cults everywhere in investing. If you're a DFA investor, my Lord, they love dimensional funds. On and on, you know, right? And the problem is, let me give you the example. So listeners, you know, you can hit pause on this podcast and go walk out to your garage. And if you don't have a garage, go walk into your closet and take a look around and look at all that junk. You say, why in God's name do I have these old bell bottoms from the 70s? Why do I have this lawnmower that doesn't work, that just needs a spark plug? Why do I have this old aquarium? And the reason is you're emotionally attached to it and you would never buy that stuff again. Are you crazy? But it's the same thing with investments. And, you know, people buy something. If you look at a lot of legacy portfolios, how many do you and I see on a daily basis?
Oh, yeah.
Someone comes in and they got 100 mutual funds and you're like, oh my God, what was this advisor doing? Or they just have just garbage. And you say, would you buy all this again today if your portfolio was sold?
Which is a great question, by the way, Meb.
That is not.
That question of would you buy today is a great question to ask.
Yeah. So we often tell people, start with a blank piece of paper, write down your zero budget portfolio, your ideal portfolio, compare it to your current portfolio. And obviously taxes are important, but say if they don't look similar, then you got a problem, right? And that's easy to fix.
Yep. By the way, on the whole list of things that you talked about, bell bottoms are coming back. They're making a comeback.
Well, so that was probably a bad example because you got some costumes. You know, I saw Kendrick Lamar, Manhattan Beach resident down near me in LA.
Uh-huh.
I was wearing them in the halftime show, so who knows?
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. I want to come back. I want to talk about your other book, Shareholder Yield, another book because you're a big writer. But I want to talk about Shareholder Yield, and I want to talk about your 351 exchange idea with your ETF. So hang on a second. And let's take a moment and talk about Interactive Brokers again, because I don't want you to be fooled by zero commissions on crypto trades. Nope. Because some brokers add a spread to the price you pay. But at Interactive Brokers, there are no hidden spreads, and you pay much less than you would at places like Gemini and Fidelity, even Robinhood. Keep more in your pocket and trade crypto for less coin at Interactive Brokers. Trading cryptocurrencies, of course, involves risk and is only for individuals with a high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. Compare other brokers' fees and see how much you could save at Interactive Brokers. Go to ibkr.com/crypto. And we're back with Meb Faber from Cambria Investments, Cambria Investment Management. He has, did you say 16 funds?
Soon to be 17 and 18.
17 and 18. We'll get to that in a second. You have another area that you really focused in on, the idea of yield, of dividend investing. Now, a lot of people, I think that's passé. You know, that was a thing of the past. You know, oh, my grandfather, he loved dividends, the blue chips. He only bought dividend stocks. These days, I don't want to buy dividend stock. I mean, I want to buy them these growth names to keep on reinvesting in themselves and using all the money they can to create incredible growth. And look what Amazon did over the years, and the Apple before they had a dividend, and you know, Microsoft and all that before they had dividends. Is this still something that's viable?
There's nothing that people love more than passive income, right? That vision of sitting on the beach, drinking a pina colada, and just letting those sweet dividend checks roll in, right? Like, yeah, I mean, I like everyone listening is just like, oh, that sounds like Homer just drinking a beer. and dividends have been, let's be clear, in our updated version of our shareholder yield book, which listeners, you can get free online. You know, we talk about this and we say, look, you know, the key part that I think a lot of people miss about dividends is you have to reinvest them to get the total equity return of, let's call it 10%. If you just go spend them, then you're not getting 10% a year, right? So you have to reinvest those dividends. But dividends and high dividend yield investing has been a time-honored strategy. But often in markets, we love to say, you know, this time is different. Has something changed? And the reality, yes, something very much did change in the 1980s and accelerated in the 1990s. Is the increase of buybacks. And buybacks, there are so many myths. We tackle this in our book on and on. People love to say buybacks used to be illegal. That's not true. There's a book on my shelf behind me from the 1970s about stock buybacks from Charlie Ellis, on and on. But buybacks, really, all they are is a tax-efficient or flexible dividend. And U.S. CEOs understand that. And they are misused sometimes, but on average, CEOs see them as flexible dividends. So buybacks now outpace dividends in any given year since the 1990s. So if you're ignoring buybacks, then you're ignoring over half of how a company distributes its cash. And why is that important? Well, it's also important because of the flip side of buybacks, which is share issuance. And you got all these CEOs in California and elsewhere that love to make it rain to the C-suite with stock options. And that is a massive dilution. So you have Charlie, the late, great Charlie Munger, talking about look for the cannibals, look for the stocks that where the companies are eating their own share count. And so, you know, our oldest fund, SYLD, goes back over, 12 years almost now, and says, hey, look, we're going to look for high quality companies that are trading at low valuations, that are distributing a large amount of cash through cash dividends and stock buybacks. On average, a company coming into our portfolio has a 10% plus yield. So think about that. Wow. But it's largely hidden. In the U.S., it's largely buybacks. The S&P yield right now is about 1.2%, which is knocking on the all-time low from 2000 of 1.11%. But that's because a lot of it shifted to buybacks. So if you ignore that, you're ignoring, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of dividend funds. You have to incorporate buybacks. Now, we also have foreign and emerging market versions of these funds. There's 5 shareholder yield funds now. But what's interesting in foreign and emerging is they still have more of a culture of dividends. And so if you look at those funds, the dividend yield tends to be up around 5, 6%. So it's closer to 50-50. They also traditionally are 10% coming in on dividends and buybacks, but it's changing. You're seeing in places like Japan, UK, China, a big shift in corporate governance and how they think about dividends and buybacks. And on average, this has surprised most people, CEOs are actually pretty good. On average, the big buybacks occur at valuation discounts to the overall market, and the share issuance on average occur to valuation premium. So you're picking up an ARB, as Buffett says. He's been right about buybacks more than anyone for the last 40 years. There's no better use of cash than to buy a stock trading at 80 cents on the dollar for a company to do a buyback.
Do you have any stats on what the actual, as you would call it, shareholder yield would be, considering the dividends and adding into it the share buybacks?
Yeah, we have... what's interesting is we have charts in the book that incorporate that. Professor DeModerin talks a lot about this. And so we have it split off to where it just looks at dividend yield. And then starting, I think, in the 80s or perhaps the 90s, it splits the chart into shareholder yield. And not surprisingly, it turns out that it looks like a more traditional dividend yield chart, right? And the way the equation works out is it definitely shifts the dividend growth higher of the overall market. But if you look at the nice thing about since we wrote the first version of the book, whatever it was, 12, 14 years ago, and the updated one today, a ton of academic literature has come out. One of my favorite papers of this cycle has been from Robico called Conservative Investing that looks at shareholder yield going back to the 1800s.
Wow.
It's a very similar to shareholder yield, you know, and finds a lot of supporting evidence, but also in foreign developed and emerging. But the cool part, you know, particularly is that it is, it varies over time. So in the US, people look at my fund and say, Meb, yeah, but you're missing out. You don't own that much tech. And I say, well, that's because a lot of tech is expensive now, and tech on average, they're share issuers. We owned Apple for almost a decade. We've owned PayPal and eBay. But if you look at emerging markets, tech is the top one or two sectors. And so it just varies over time and varies by what's going on in the world. But it finds opportunity, you know, kind of wherever the companies are have the cash and are returning it to shareholders.
Yep. Now, you mentioned you're going to have some new funds coming out. I know you're really excited about this one, so I'm kind of saving it. I have some things to talk about otherwise, but let's just get right to this now since we're talking about some of your funds. There's a new, I guess, a new genre of fund that you're bringing to your lineup.
This is exciting. So we've been at this for a long time. We launched our first fund again in 2013. And one of the reasons we fully embraced ETFs at that point is said, look, this is just a better mousetrap on average. Bank of America recently put out a piece. They say, look, the average ETF in the equity world compared to the average mutual fund adds about 1.2% up to 1.7% per year additional return from fee and tax savings, but the tax savings being a big one. The average ETF on an average year does not pay capital gains. It's just a better structure. And I mean, look back in the last couple of years. I mean, you have mutual funds. My favorite article every year is Morningstar, and they're like, here's the mutual funds paying out 20, 40% of NAV and capital gains.
Right, when they've only made 2%.
Or you could even have a loss. You could have a loss yeah. That's and ugly. Be paying taxes.
That's
and so... Look, you know, but the world gets it. The flows every year into ETFs or, you know, tax efficient vehicles is widening. It's like a big alligator jaws. So we've long thought about fees and taxes. And so I was hanging out with a good nerd buddy of mine, Wes Gray, at ETF Architect. We did a few podcasts with him and kind of nerding out on some topics. And he's very tax focused. I mean, he lives in Puerto Rico, so he has to be. But, you know, a former Chicago PhD. And we were talking about this idea where you started to see, since the ETF rule passed in 2019, a lot of mutual funds convert to ETFs. So DFA did, I don't know, 100 billion of conversions. A lot of these companies say, hey, look, we get it. ETFs are great. We're going to convert and benefit from this tax efficiency. But you've also seen hedge funds convert and asset managers roll up some of their separate accounts and launch an ETF. And I kind of scratched my head and I said, you know, why couldn't we theoretically do this open enrollment? And he scratched his head and he says, I think we could. And so what this means, so most investors are familiar with the 1031, mm-hmm. right? The real mm-hmm. estate transaction where you buy a building 20 years later, you've had a 10 bagger on it. You're like, oh, I want to sell it, but I don't want to pay taxes. So 1031 lets you sell that building and roll it into another real estate investment tax-free or tax-deferred, right? You're not washing the taxes, you're just deferring them. And this is how generations have built wealth in the real estate space. And historically, there hasn't been a choice for that in the stock world. Now, there's been exchange funds. An exchange fund historically, let's say you got $100 million of NVIDIA. Well, you could go to Eaton Vance or Goldman. They'll probably charge you 1.5% to set it up and another percent per year. And you contribute it. You got to hold it for 7 years. But you get back a portfolio of what other people contributed. So often it's, you know, you put in NVIDIA and you get back the Qs or something. So it's often not really a particularly great solution. It's very high fees. Anyway, on and on. But it turns out there's a part of the tax code that's been around forever called 1031. 351. Sorry, I haven't had enough coffee today. 351. And 351 is essentially, you have the modern interpretation and application of it. And there's been hundreds of these that have been done. Most people just haven't heard of them yet because it hasn't been available, broadly speaking. So we actually did our first one of these in December. But we basically said, look, we're going to launch ETFs. And if you want to seed them, you can. If you want to buy it afterwards, after it's launched, great. Just like our other, you know, 16 funds have launched with no seed. But I said, this one, you're allowed to seed. And so there's two main rules if you want to seed this fund. And if you have a highly appreciated stock portfolio. So let's say you own the Mag 7 or 20 stocks, highly appreciated. Say, look, Meb, I know NVIDIA is expensive, Palantir, AppLovin, whatever I own, all these stocks, but I can't sell them. Tax man's going to kill me. My mom used to say that about GE. And I said, well, Mom, the problem on the taxes is eventually someone's going to solve that for you, the market or the IRS. But eventually that problem will be cured. So you can also just sell it. But wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to? And so 351, we said we're going to launch three funds. It'll be a buffet of choices, but the first one's already happened. We said you can seed it. So let's say you have 20 stocks. There's two rules. The first rule is the biggest stock can't be over 25%. So there's diversification requirements. You can't just give me 100 million NVIDIA. You could give me 25 million NVIDIA and 75 million something else. Or... and the second rule is anything above 5% has to sum to less than 50. So you could give me 25 million NVIDIA, 25 million AppLovin, and then another 51% of 10 other stocks. And so you contribute this portfolio and the ETF accepts it, launch date. So let's say you got a Schwab account and... you look up your Schwab account the next day, and guess what? You have our ETF. And the cool part about the ETF is the ETF can then rebalance tax efficiently and move to whatever strategy it's targeting. So for the first one we did was U.S. stocks. The second one we're doing is this endowment style, which is an aggressive asset allocation. And the third one this summer will be an equal weight stock portfolio global. And so it's kind of a buffet of choices. And so again, this isn't a tax wash. You're not making the taxes disappear, but in your Schwab account now, you'll have tax line items of this ETF that relate to each contribution you made. So if you bought NVIDIA at $1, you now own this ETF at that cost basis of $1. If you have AppLovin at $2, you now have that. So it's a great way to diversify away from a concentrated portfolio. The second big use case is for direct indexing. You know, direct indexing is a great option for investors, but historically after 5-10 years, you're kind of stuck in highly appreciated stocks. But it's also great for financial advisors because there's a lot of clients out there, and you've probably had this experience where you talk to somebody's high net worth, say, okay, look, I like you, I need your help, but I'm not going to give you my 50 million of Microsoft because I can't sell it. So there's no real reason for you to charge me on it. And I also can't diversify and I don't want to pay Eaton Vance a bunch for an exchange fund. I'm kind of stuck in it. So now a lot of financial advisors can go to these people and say, hey, I have a solution for you. We can now diversify this holding and get you closer to where you want to be. So I think this is a topic and an idea you're going to hear a ton about it. We have resources on our website. You can go to CambriaInvestments.com or Cambria Funds. There's a 351 tab. But it's a really interesting idea that I said last year it's going to be bigger story eventually than the crypto ETFs, which were a big story. I think they raised $100 billion last year. But I think eventually this is a really cool solution for all sorts of ideas and interpretations and applications.
So do I get – is that ETF that was created? Is that the Andrew Horowitz ETF?
You can do this numerous ways. So Cambria said, we're going to do a buffet where we're going to have lots of people contribute. It's financial advisors. We're the first to take on individuals. People contribute it, and then they have our Cambria ETF afterwards. There's also people that have come to us and say, hey, Meb, look, I got, I don't know, 100 million, 500 million, a billion of assets that I would like to do this with. However, as much as I like you, I don't want your harebrained strategy. I want XYZ. I want the Horowitz ETF that does, you know, dogs of the Dow, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Can you help me launch this? And the answer to that is sure, right? As long as it's not, if you come to me and say, Meb, I want the Horowitz 2X MicroStrategy Bitcoin. You know, long fartcoin, I'll say, sorry, man. Yeah. Sorry. Go talk to someone else.
Soon to be called Strategy. The stock,
but you've actually seen this. So yeah. Goldman did one recently with over a billion. Often it's an asset manager that's saying, you know, hey, I run this model portfolio that's got a bunch of gains, or I have these 10 investors that have highly appreciated positions and I want to roll them into our model strategy. Let's launch an ETF and do this. Now, the follow-up question is always, why haven't more people done this? And the answer to that is, it's a huge pain in the butt. So it's a lot of work. So if you think about an Excel sheet that has 1,000 tabs, so the main thing that, you know, people need to contribute to. So let's say you're a listener and you say, oh, Meb, I like this. I got perfect. I want to send you something. Well, you got to send me an Excel sheet with, you know, your positions and tax lots. So already people are like too lazy to do that, or it's like too much work. Eventually software solves this. I think, you know, it just, you link your brokerage account. We say, okay, here's what works. But for now it's very manual, which is why we work with Wes and Pat at their firm. It's a bunch of Marines, right? They have that Marine military efficiency. But it's eventually you would assume some of the bigger players, but you know, BlackRock launches a fund. It goes to 10 billion anyway. They don't need to do this. Yep. And they may do it as a service to, you know, some of their biggest clients, but in the reality, I see a future where every ETF launch, you could say, hey, you have the option, click this button if you want to seed it, or you just want to buy it afterwards. That's cool too. I neglected to mention ETFs are pass-through. So you could give me 100% SPY or Qs, you know, if the portfolio is diversified. You know, you can't do private funds. You can't do, you know, spot Bitcoin. You can't do micro pink sheets, all that sort of stuff. But anything that's usually publicly traded, particularly in the U.S., is good to go.
Now, two things. Number one, just so everybody knows, Wes Gray is actually scheduled for the March 23rd show. So we'll have some discussion with him. He hasn't been on for a while. So we can blend this into that discussion, which is great.
He's great. He's crazy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And the other thing is, this is one question, I guess, that I'm missing this. So now I put in my highly appreciated assets, right? And we know that there's some tax efficiency here. What is the tax efficiency in that? By seeding it with those low costs, I'm not getting away from that, but the you sell a piece of NVIDIA to buy something, right? Or in there?
Yeah, so remember, so like once it comes in, I don't like using the word tax-free, but you know, essentially ETFs, because of the way they rebalance, the custom creation redemptions, the media likes to call them heartbeat trades, you know, you're not paying out capital gains. And that's the whole point of the ETF structure. So let's say we take in this portfolio, this next one we're doing is endowment portfolio, you know, and over time, it could be in the first week, if the portfolio is very similar to our final portfolio, it could be 3, 6, 12 months. But over time, that portfolio will gravitate towards the eventual portfolio of the prospectus and ETF. You know, again, it varies by what's going on. Usually they're like 90% correlation out the gate, because you get to choose what you accept. So we would never accept 100% NVIDIA into this fund, because that's not what we want. And so, you know, the ETFs do rebalancing, and they do it through custom creation redemption. And eventually you end up that portfolio, but those are not taxable transactions.
Right. Until such time as you sell, let's just take it to the conclusion. If you sell the whole thing, if somebody decides to, whatever reason, then you're taxed.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a deferral. It's almost identical to a 1031. So the reason to do it for most people is they're like, look, I got a highly concentrated portfolio and I don't want it. I want to be diversified, or I want something more diversified. That's usually the biggest one, direct indexing too, but it gives them a way to not have all their money usually in one stock or one market or something. And right. But again, so
as a side note, by the way, this is a brilliant business plan for you, because once in, there's no reason to get out.
And hopefully, you know, that allows us to offer funds at lower costs,
yeah,
you know, and continually sure reduce our fees. You know, that's kind of our goal.
I think it's great.
Yeah. And eventually you can donate it. You can, you know, pass it on to your heirs. You can sell it a nice piece. But let's say you say, hey, look, I just want to get rid of my NVIDIA. And so I'm going to contribute $100 million, where $25 million is NVIDIA, $75 million is SPY. Well, the fund launches, and then you got $100 million. You can sell, like, let's say you contribute SPY that has no gain. Well, you can just go to sell the SPY, right? And so then you just diversified your NVIDIA, and then the SPY, you know, you can do whatever you want with it, yeah, put it in bonds.
Love that.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is officially launched.
We did the first one, and you can only see this, listeners, on the launch. So you can't contribute after. So now our first one was the ticker was called Tax. So now you can go buy Tax, but you can't seed it. The next one will be ENDW in April. We're taking indications of interest now in February and March. And again, that's actually a leveraged aggressive allocation ETF that tracks the endowment style of investing. It's a pretty fun one. And then we'll have another one in sort of August, September. You know, the big thing I think is education, make sure people understand it, and then kind of go through the process. But yeah, reach out.
To be clear, because you mentioned some large numbers with a lot of zeros. If mm-hmm. somebody wants to be part of a seeding process, what numbers are we talking about?
My goal is, the whole point that I've struggled, also I neglected to mention exchange funds, you got to be qualified or accredited, right? So you got to be rich.
Yep, sure.
For this, my goal is for this to come down as low as possible. You know, we said for the first one or two, just so we get the plumbing right, just so we make sure this is smooth, we set the million at a minimum, at a million.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that comes down to 500,000, 100,000 in the future and down. But for right now, just to make sure that we're not trying to do this with 10,000 people, I don't think I could handle it.
Right. So basically, just to be clear, for anybody listening, this is an alternative to an exchange fund that's very approachable, a much different process, a much better overall ease, I would say. And it has the availability, because a lot of exchange funds, they just kind of keep what it is and you just mix them all up.
And right. Often, you know,
there's nothing happening.
There's some disruption happening in the exchange fund world too. And you can ask Wesk about that. Hopefully coming this summer, you know, there's other companies like Cash is one that's trying to offer a lower cost, modern interpretation of the exchange fund. But again, the biggest challenge is you just end up with whatever people contributed. So if you're a U.S. investor, you got all your money in U.S. stocks. U.S. stocks have been a 10 bagger since 2009.
Right.
And you're like, man, I need to diversify away from this. A lot of exchange funds, you just end up back in the S&P. Maybe you want that, but maybe you don't. Maybe you want something else. So it's an alternative solution that we think is pretty cool.
Good stuff. Meb Faber from Cambria Investments. I'm going to Cambria Funds, of course. And I want to make sure that people also know that you have a fabulous podcast with great guests and great discussions on an ongoing basis. And that's running. When did you start that? That was a long time ago.
We're up north of 500 episodes. What are you at now? You're a podcast alum.
900.
Woo! Man. Who are you going to have for 1,000?
Since 07.
Yeah. Who's going to be your 1,000 reveal?
I don't know. Planning that out. You know, I haven't had on. I haven't had, I'm drawing a blank for his name. You just mentioned him earlier, the guy with the great quotes, the guy with the book, Morgan. I haven't had Morgan on for years.
Donald Trump?
Yeah, no. I haven't had Morgan on for years.
He has the best words.
He'll be the best. Yeah. Morgan Housel, for whatever reason, I've tried to get in touch with him a few times, and He's just not really responded. So I haven't had him on for, I had him on before he was Morgan Housel, if you know what I'm saying.
There you go.
You know? Way, way back in the day. So anyway, all the information on how to get information on Meb's, of his great funds and his family, the 3351 seeding / ETF exchanges, or if that's not the right word, but this way of doing things, be on the show notes of episode 910 over on The Disciplined Investor. Thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's a blast as always.
Thanks, Ben. See ya. And that's going to wrap up this exciting show. We talked about things that probably you haven't heard about, brand new off the block. That's why I was telling you to get your pencils ready in the beginning of this show. 351 exchange ideas. We talked about the IV portfolio and the idea of how you can invest like an endowment. And what's wrong with dividend or yielders if, in fact, we combine in the fact that you have shareholder buybacks or share buybacks going on with that. So something to think about on all that, and home court bias and home country bias. And, you know, the idea is survival is key. Thanks for joining me this edition, this episode, this week of The Disciplined Investor. Make sure to also listen to DH Unplugged each and every week with myself and John C. Dvorak, where we just hash it out and talk about some funny things. I got to tell you, just thinking about it makes me laugh. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.